It's the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Catherine Kellerman has been on the job as CEO of the Port Authority of Allegheny County for a little more than a year. 2019 could be as busy as the last. Catherine, welcome back to the Confluence.
Thank you for having me, Kevin.
Let's start maybe with an easy one, but I'd like one in each column, if you would. One thing you did that the agency accomplished in the past year that pleases you, and conversely, one thing that didn't get done that you really wanted to do and maybe fell a little short on.
Well, I would say it was a 2018 reaffirmed all the decisions my husband and I made to come to Pittsburgh. It has been a fantastic town that our kids love. The neighborhoods, all 90 of them, and then all the neighborhoods outlying the city are fantastic. There were no hurricanes, which made us really happy coming up from Florida. And coming to the job, the thing that has been so pleasant for me, and is really a huge advantage for us here in Pittsburgh, is how many folks who work with us at Port Authority were just waiting for an opportunity to be excellent, to, I don't want to say be unleashed, but to have the opportunity to do their job and take care of our customers. This internal sense of taking care of Allegheny County and doing so with pride has just been fantastic. And it makes this road forward as we continue to focus on an excellent customer experience that fuels Allegheny County. It makes it easier to take that trip, and I know we're all in it together. Something that didn't get done, geez, well, it's less of things that didn't get done and more of Mother Nature. So we had two floods and a derailment last year. And I have to tell you, the call I never thought I would get is, "Hey, boss, a train landed on us." So it was a challenge. But again, we were open from that in 13 days, which did not happen by accident. Our crews were out there working 24/7 to get folks back onto the tracks. We do continue to focus on on-time performance, and I would love that number to be higher, but we are putting a lot of effort into that for this year because we're only as good as we are reliable.
Of course, you're alluding to the Norfolk Southern derailment last summer. Have you reached a satisfactory agreement with Norfolk Southern?
So we've got our math put together of the actual damage to the rail and the overhead. I want to say it was 1,600 feet of rail replaced, 4,000 feet of overhead wire. The wear and take, the time for our crews to go out there, the replacements for the the communication boxes or the fiber optic, the fiber cable. So we've pulled our costs together, and I think we're right about at the point that our attorneys are going to send it over to Norfolk Southern. So once the attorneys do the handshake over that number, we'll have that ready for release.
As you know, as you came in taking this job, you know the Port Authority for years was trying to secure its financing, seeking to avoid additional cuts, of additional fare hikes. Is the agency now in more of a planning, expanding, upgrading mode than just sort of stabilizing?
Absolutely. And we owe a huge debt to the previous CEO, Ellen McLean, who had a very, very strong finance background. We're in a very strong financial position. We also have a debt to the Pennsylvania State Legislature and here our county executive. We are in the midst of a 10-year status quo funding plan. This is funded under Act 89 state law. So we know that in a 10-year window, we can keep everything on the road and keep things running appropriately. Now it's time to set forth a vision of what transit and transportation can be in Allegheny County and figure out what that costs and how to make the case to pay for that. Allegheny County deserves better than transit that is funded like your college kid who says, "Oh, I have $10, let's eat ramen," right? Mm-hmm. We need to be thinking, what is the vision? What should we be doing in 2045? Price that out and then work toward that funding. So we set out with a goal of an excellent system that runs 24 hours a day, that has a dedicated guideway out to the airport that can get folks back and forth to these jobs all throughout the area and get them there seamlessly, reliably, and again, an excellent experience. So let's build that vision and then we can put a price tag to it. We're definitely in a planning mode.
Looking out 10, 20, 25 years, where does ridership come into play as far as what sort of numbers do you need to make that happen to show that people want this, people need it?
That is an excellent question. We have been growing ridership here at Port Authority over at least the last year. So every year we're stronger than that month the year previously. Last year we were about 2% system-wide up. Now that doesn't sound like a big number, but 2% on a system carrying nearly 250,000 people a day, that's a lot of trips back and forth. It's our highest number in 4 years, and this bucks a national trend. So nationally you see systems losing 2 to 3% annually. In more sprawling environments, systems can be losing 8 to 12% annually. So we don't have those problems, these issues where folks have moved to different neighborhoods or they've just gotten to where they can't rely on transit or other factors have impacted them. We're not seeing that here in Allegheny County. So while gas is still at historic lows, more people are riding us. While rideshare is coming to town, while we're happy to see great growth with our friends in bike share, our ridership continues to grow. And our numbers, objectively speaking, are stronger than you see in other systems that may have built big BRT networks, that might have had larger rail networks. So we know we have the ridership base. It's more looking at the economic benefit of putting in a permanent structure. So, for instance, bus rapid transit in Oakland, we know can be a tipping point for improved service on the bus, but more reliable service. So folks don't anticipate a traffic jam, and they might rent an office space in Oakland that they wouldn't have otherwise. They also know they have a dedicated passenger base and a dedicated employment base. So we know we can bring that to bear. So it's not just ridership when we're looking at those benefits for transit.
I mentioned fares just a moment or so ago. On January 25th, the Port Authority Board voted to approve hiring a consultant to study fare equity policies. What will this entail? Will you be looking at the possibility of free transfers, fare capping, cash payers versus Connect card users?
So all of the above. The goal of any transit system should be that a passenger already has their fare covered by the time they get to the vehicle, so that you have a pass or something which is paid so you can board easily. That puts pressure on a transit agency to have a good, reasonable, and equitable fare structure, enough outlets where people can get their fare cards, and a fast, passenger-friendly way to make this happen. So, for instance, if you have a fare card and you don't know if it's been loaded or not, you might be apprehensive about getting on the bus because if your car doesn't work, is another passenger rude to you? Do you cause a traffic jam? Getting rid of issues like that is the best for everyone in a system. We would love to fare cap. In fact, that's something that I've been talking about since I came on last year. There's no reason that somebody should have to pay more than the cost of a day pass just because they couldn't get to a $7 day pass. And even if we make fare revenue off of that, it is not the right thing to do. So these consultants will help us look at if we go to fare capping, what's the financial impact of that? And we can factor that in our budget so we can do good by doing well for the agency. And fare capping isn't just a one-day thing. It would be if you've bought enough day passes that you turn into a weekly pass and so on. That will be less money for the agency. So let's have someone help us with the math so we know what to anticipate and we can move in that direction. Transfers are very similar. If you have a free transfer, when folks ask for that, they're clearly not saying make people pay for each trip that they take. So how do you allow someone to pay one fare and then not the next one and the next one? Is that a day pass change? How do you accomplish that? What's the price tag and how do you commit to rolling it out in a way that doesn't take money out of the pockets where we're trying to show that we're a good investment for all of our taxpayers.
Do you think the day pass will solve the concerns of individuals who say, look, we can't afford to put X amount of dollars into a Connect card that might get us, you know, really 2 weeks, 3 weeks, a month worth of riding? I mean, we can just afford day to day, and that's how we have to pay for things.
What I really believe would be helpful, and we're talking to our vendors about this, would be opening up. We have wonderful partnerships, for instance, with Giant Eagle, where you can go in and get a Connect card. But places where folks can't get to a Giant Eagle, can we go to a Dollar General or a local store? And if they're very small stores that can't afford the infrastructure for a Connect card, can we get a prepaid card, like a gift card, right? And have it plastic wrapping up at the front. So the day pass then becomes ubiquitous. And if someone gets that day pass and they want to register on their phone, ideally with free Wi-Fi, if we can have that on the bus, then they could register and then that card has a memory tied to them and that can give them the ability to fare cap. So not just getting a Connect card in people's hands, it's making sure everyone has access to the FAIR tool that makes sense for them, and we pay attention to keeping it fair for people.
How long are you expecting this review to take? And in the meantime, current policies are in place, and are people, low-income riders, a little bit antsy about that?
We do hear back from folks asking us for fare changes. A point to remember is 2 years ago, we got rid of our zone-based fares. At that time, the average passenger was paying about $1.69 per trip. As soon as we got rid of the zones, we went down to $1.53. So definitely cheaper for a patron, but a 10% loss in our fare recovery at that point. We're up to about $1.59 right now. So we're nowhere near back to the high, but we are, folks are paying a little bit more out of pocket on each trip at the same time that our expenses have gone up. The increase in fare, I want to say, has been less than the increase in our total cost. So we have done some improvements. I would be anxious, too, if it was my mother or grandmother traveling like this, I'd want it tomorrow. But if we make a fare change and aren't ready to find the funding to cover that loss of revenue in the future and it takes away the bus my grandmother wanted, then I'm not happy either. So we need to make sure we're not creating that circumstance. To your question, this is a three-year contract with 2 one-year bases, but it won't take 3 years to do this study. And we anticipate some good information by the summer and some recommendations we could take to our board through the end of this year, if not sooner. Under Federal Transit Administration guidelines, any changes to a fare structure require a public hearing process. So that is a little bit broader, takes more time, but it makes sure folks can weigh in on what's important to them.
And therefore, the other couple years would be what, follow-up analysis?
Follow-up, absolutely. And if so let's say this year we get a recommendation to drastically change how we structure fares, and we want to implement that in 2 or 3 years, this allows that same vendor to be on hand for us and doing the math when we make these implementations. So we have the same set of eyes, and again, we know we're doing the right thing.
One of the first things you did in early spring of last year was to sort of ease concerns about the impact of the proposed bus rapid transit, the BRT, on routes to and from the Mon Valley. A new application was put in the fall to the federal government for funding. What's the status of this? Have you heard anything?
We have not. We would normally think we'd hear back this month, but the Federal Transit Administration was caught up in the government shutdown. So our friends at the FTA had a 5-week vacation, whether or not they wanted one. So they are catching up with all of their work and activity. We would still anticipate some level of decision February, March, presuming there's not another shutdown. But we are right on track for where we're headed.
County Executive Rich Fitzgerald said, even if the answer is no, somehow the BRT is going to get done. Are you confident that can happen? If they say no, how long of a delay might that be in actually implementing?
It will absolutely happen. The improvements in this corridor are too important for us not to make them. But a point to remember is the goal for our BRT isn't just to, it's not to get more people around. This corridor is almost 10% of all of our ridership, if not more. We have a bus every 1.8 minutes coming through Oakland. The goal is to make this corridor more reliable. So instead of those buses really do come every 2 minutes, not one bus and a 10-minute delay because of traffic. We're really focusing with our partners at the city and the county on signals, making it easier for buses to get through the intersection, letting the bus go first so they can jump a traffic queue, for instance, making good improvements in the quality of the bus stop. If we do this without federal assistance, we will rescope the project. We might have a smaller bus stop. We might have some compliance things we don't have to do so we can save some money. But one way or another, we are definitely making improvements in this corridor.
If they don't give you an answer, just don't give you any answer. I mean, how long can you hold off just sort of waiting for an answer before you say, you know what, we've got to move forward?
We're moving forward with improvements right now. We are right now in the procurement evaluation process for piloting some apps on the phone. Now, why is that important? That lets us test drive all-door boarding. All-door boarding is critical to BRT success, but I tell you, we could use it today at Smithfield and 6 at our superstop. If folks could board at all doors and not have to pay fares, that would greatly improve our running speed. We're already test driving these things. So we're not waiting until we get a yes or no. We're trying to implement these improvements today.
You're testing a new website supposed to help riders know more about their routes. When's that supposed to launch? I mean, there are, let's face it, a number of app creators out there that can provide some information. What do you hope this provides that others cannot?
Well, there are a lot of really great apps which are out there. Our old website, probably was created before some of these apps were around. So we have a lot of technology we can catch up on. And while an app can tell you where your vehicle should be in about 3 minutes, if you want to know where your bus could connect to, how often it runs 2 days from now, what is the next meeting coming up for the Port Authority Board, that still is a website function. So the new website's in beta right now. People go to portauthority.org. You can click on the box about testing the website. Please do that and use the form to send feedback. We know folks want to tweet at us or send us Facebook messages. We're trying to keep all our feedback in one stream so it's easier to follow back up and make sure we're hitting these things. The buttons folks use most often will be displayed right on the home screen, and it's scalable, so what you see on the screen is what you see on your phone. You're not losing anything. So right at the beginning is, where's my vehicle? What are the fares? How do I get around? And you can go through for further information.
When is this beyond the testing, though?
So we hope to have the new website up and running this spring, ideally the earlier part of spring than the later part of spring.
Catherine Kellerman is the CEO of the Port Authority of Allegheny County. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you for the opportunity.
I'm Kevin Gavin. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Megan Harris. The Confluence airs live from 9 to 10 a.m., but the news never stops. Find more stories, conversations, and more on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Pennsylvania's first female attorney general and state Supreme Court Justice Anne X. Alburn dies in 1981. Alburn was born in Russia and moved to southwestern Pennsylvania as a child, earning her bachelor and law degrees from the University of Pittsburgh. She was appointed to become Pittsburgh City Solicitor in 1942, becoming the only woman in a major American city to hold the position. She was then appointed by then-Governor David Lawrence to become Attorney General of the Commonwealth. There, she investigated fraud cases against elected officials. In 1961, she became the first woman to hold a seat on the Supreme Court of Pennsylvania. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac.
It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Governor Tom Wolf has proposed a $34.1 billion budget that does not include any broad-based tax hikes. Republicans have responded somewhat favorably to Wolf's proposal, but there are still some potential pitfalls. 90.5 WESA's Katie Meyer kicks off our state budget coverage.
Wolf's plan would hike overall spending by about $1 billion, routing the money toward things like a moderate education boost, childcare funding, investments in new state police equipment, and helping counties purchase new voting machines. But as the Democrat notes, there is a major feature that should appease Republicans.
Let me cut to the chase. This proposal asks for no new taxes.
A lot of the new cash would come from savings initiatives in human services and debt management. But other money-making proposals are more contentious. Take a call for increasing the minimum wage gradually to $15 an hour. Wolf's banking on $120 million from the change in the first year. Many GOP leaders oppose that. House Majority Leader Brian Cutler didn't totally shoot down the idea, but says it probably shouldn't be part of the budget.
My question has always been, where is the market at already? Clearly, the market's moved beyond that in the majority of our jobs. I think it's more important to focus on the areas where we all agree, workforce development, that actually provides for wages far higher than minimum wage.
Wolf also wants to charge fees for state police coverage in municipalities that don't have their own police forces, a proposal that's gained some traction in the past but never full-throated support. But the governor's primary focus was where the money is going. And as Cutler notes, Wolf says he's most concerned with workforce investment.
When Amazon made its decision to locate its second headquarters somewhere other than Pennsylvania, it cited workforce concerns as a main reason.
One of the new initiatives to address the issue, a workforce command center chaired by state secretaries and officers, union leaders, and business backers.
If the Department of Community and Economic Development knows that a company needs 20 welders and the Department of Labor and Industry has a welding program, we're going to connect them.
Republicans' initial reactions to the budget address were pretty positive, like from Senate Majority Leader Jake Corman.
Maybe we'll break with tradition, normal tradition, as the opposition parties to come out and sort of complain about the governor's proposal. I think there is a lot there that we can embrace and get behind, at least generically.
But Pat Brown, a Republican who chairs the Senate's Appropriations Committee, says he still thinks Wolf is trying to spend too much money.
Governor's rate of growth over the enacted budget last year is 4.3%. That is not a sustainable number given our revenue capacity.
House Republicans are indicating they agree with Brown's assessment. State revenues have been generally strong this past year, but the budget does include what's known as a supplemental appropriation, $500 million to cover a funding gap that opened up last year. At the state capitol, I'm Katie Meyer.
And I'm Emily Previty. Wolf wants municipalities without their own police force to pay for law enforcement support from state troopers, which currently are provided at no cost. The governor's previously called for a $25 per person payment from local governments. Today's proposal is a bit different, though. It would start at $8 per capita for municipalities with 2,000 or fewer residents, $17 per capita for those with between 3,000 and 4,000 people, and so on, scaling up $8 per capita for every 1,000 residents. It would top out at $166 per capita for communities with 20,000 or more. But York County Republican State Representative Stan Saylor says that ask is too steep.
Just about every municipality in Pennsylvania would have to pay it, and in some cases that'd be quite a financial burden on them.
Saylor says a phase-in would be better. Others say it's not quite enough to dissuade communities from relying on state police for law enforcement. Wolf's funding plan would generate less than a quarter of the estimated cost for state police to provide coverage in communities without local law enforcement. Just over half of the Commonwealth's 2,600 municipalities get full-time state police coverage presently. Another 400 or so have it part-time, and the list grows every year.
I'm Avi Wolfman-Aaron. Education remains at the center of Wolf's agenda. He swept into office 4 years ago promising big spikes to public school spending. He fought with Republican leaders over how to raise the money and ultimately settled for less than he wanted. Now he's asking for an extra $200 million in basic education funding, half of what he requested 4 years ago. His administration calls it a feasible, responsible proposal.
We must continue to increase funding for education, starting with pre-K and culminating at the end of a student's journey.
Republican leaders say they'll listen, but they're concerned that much of the existing education budget goes to rising health care and pension costs. Lancaster County's Brian Cutler is the new House Majority Leader.
We want to ensure that any increases in education funding reaches students and their classrooms, not just institutions where costs continue to go up.
Wolf also raised eyebrows with a proposal to set the minimum teacher salary at $45,000 a year. That would use state funds to raise wages for about 3,000 mostly rural teachers. He also proposed a study to look at the benefits of universal full-day kindergarten, and he wants to lower the mandatory school age from 8 to 6.
The proposed budget includes $15 million aimed at helping people with intellectual disabilities and autism. Department of Human Services Secretary Teresa Miller says the plan addresses a recurring problem of long wait lists for people who need services.
Not everyone who has an intellectual disability or autism is getting all of the services that they either currently need or may need in the future. So this initiative will allow us to serve an additional 765 individuals who are on particularly the emergency wait list.
Miller says the allocation also includes funding to help about 100 people who might experience unanticipated emergencies. Other human services programs include new training opportunities to help people become self-sufficient and a parent pathways initiative based on an existing program at Misericordia University that helps single mothers trying to get a college degree or training credential.
This is a program that is ending generational poverty, because not only are these moms graduating with their college degree, but their kids are growing up on a college campus and they're graduating from college.
Governor Wolf says he's also renewing key health department efforts, including efforts to prevent opioid addiction.
Continued investments to reinforce our commitment to the battle against the opioid epidemic that has claimed the lives of so many of our neighbors.
That includes an additional $1.5 million for the overdose-reversing drug naloxone.
That was Brett Schultes, Avi Wolfman-Arendt, Emily Previty, and Katie Meyer. You're listening to The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
The
It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Guns and gun violence are topics of discussion at public hearings and community meetings, and even in synagogues and churches. But the Quantum Theater is bringing the subject to three different communities in different venues through their new production, The Gun Show. Joining us on The Confluence are the founder and artistic director of Quantum Theater, Carlo Boos, and the playwright of The Gun Show, E.M. Lewis, who goes by Ellen. Welcome, Ellen. Welcome, Carlo.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Carlo, I'm going to start with you. What made you want to sort of talk about guns, address this issue through theater?
Well, first of all, there's a subtitle to that play, right. The Gun Show, Can We Talk About This, is the full title that we're using. And it was brought to me by Andrew Smith, a beautiful actor that I've known, and he's worked for Quantum a couple times. And two things struck me more than a year ago when he brought the play to me, that the subject was so topical and the playwriting was so interesting. The way the play communicates and the way we all understand that theater is about empathy, and it's about cracking open some of the narrower definitions of self. Mm-hmm. This play did it in unusual, beautiful ways. That was a year ago, before Parkland, before Tree of Life. So my feelings about the fact that we're doing it have deepened quite a bit, and it's so personal to every American, but certainly to me as a Pittsburgher.
So how does The Gun Show, Can We Talk About This, sort of fit into Quantum Theater's mission? It's experimentation.
Well, that's it. I mean, we are experimenters, and folks who know us know that our work is super eclectic. The last thing we did was called Chatterton, and it was in Trinity Cathedral, and it was very grand. We'll do Shakespeare after The Gun Show, but we also, we're looking to explore theatrical language. We're looking to push the boundaries of the art form, and I look for works that do that for me. This one does it completely and totally.
All right. Well, let's talk about the work. Ellen, so basic question, what influenced you to write this play?
It was a number of things, but I think it started with the fact that I come from rural Oregon. I grew up on a small farm and have made my way through more urban places over the course of my life, but feel that I've always had one foot in two worlds. The world that I come from is a place where people had guns. Farms were a little bit far apart from each other. Law enforcement was a little bit far away from where we were. And most people had a couple shotguns leaning up against their back door for personal safety, but also for, you know, the occasional raccoon who was coming after the chickens, for very practical ways. But my feelings about guns have grown more complicated over the course of my life and through personal experiences with them. Mm-hmm. And I couldn't not write this play.
Couldn't not. You had to.
I had to.
There is a line from The Gun Show. Quote, "The commentary is killing the conversation. We need to talk from what we have in common. We all want to be safe." Is that the essence of the message that you're trying to get through in this play?
I think what the play is looking for is what we do have in common and where we can start a conversation with each other. It feels like in America right now, on this subject and on so many subjects, we are so polarized. We are so, the shouting, there's so much shouting and not a lot of listening to each other and looking for common ground and a place to begin moving forward together. We all live here together in this country, we in each community, and we need to figure out the important things together. The shouting isn't working. I want to talk.
And I think that I'm reflecting on your question about why this theater is doing it and what is our point as a theater, Quantum Theater. What a beautiful thing to engage with, you know, that conversation. All art is really a conversation among people trying to get at something a little bit deeper with each other. So here we are.
Mm-hmm. Ellen, are these your stories? I mean, you mentioned rural Oregon.
Yes.
So they're told through a male lead actor.
They are. I don't know why this play wanted to be told in that way, because they are very personal stories from my own life and experience. Mostly what I write is fiction, you know, plays that are stories. This one is true. This one is my own personal experiences, five stories of my experiences with guns in America over the course of my life. But, boy, Andrew Smith is a wonderful actor to share this.
Right. Carla, you chose to have the production presented in three communities, three different venues, different types of venues. Why the different settings and why these three communities?
Well, I always look for what quantum theater and our unique sort of ethos can offer to any project. And I thought that I really got that this is meant to be a conversation among real people following from the sharing of Ellen's personal stories in the play. And I thought Pittsburgh is a city of neighborhoods. Each neighborhood is looking at this issue through their neighborhood lens. And I really thought if only we could move the production and have the people in the room be quite different and represent, perhaps in some ways that we can't control, the spectrum of Americans that Ellen is trying to address through the play. So I'm so happy that it turned out that we do have three communities.
Right. So it's going to start in Homewood at the Carnegie Library. Then they'll move on to CCAC, the Allegheny campus on the north side, and finally in Swickley.
The Tull Family Theater, yes.
Exactly. But so why those three?
Well, we talked about what kind of places are appropriate, and mm-hmm. we said Sheila McKenna, the director, Andrew, and we communicated this to Ellen, and she agreed completely that they should be places of community convening and learning. And really civic spaces in one way or another. And we reached out to a lot of places, but the Carnegie Library seemed absolutely a no-brainer. And I'm happy to say that they generously and immediately said yes. They were courageous. They didn't have to think about it. The Homewood branch was their suggestion. It's a beautiful place. And it is a very specific community to be opening the play that absolutely has their own feelings. I don't want to generalize, but I would say Homewood has some things to say about gun violence. Mm-hmm. I'll say that we investigated lots of other places and events in America affected our investigation. We talked to suburban high schools. We thought that might be interesting. And their issues right now are too sensitive. We had yeses that turned into noes. We talked to, I think it's okay to say, McGee Women's Hospital, that has a beautiful gathering space within it. And it was under serious consideration until a shooting in a Chicago hospital happened. Right. And then it was an immediate no. They have more serious things to do.
Right.
But we do have that suburban, different, not inner city location in the Tull Family Theater. So brave and wonderful of them. They really serve Beaver County as well as the interesting town of Sewickley. And we love being among a young population in CCAC. They are serving a specifically diverse and wonderful constituency of students. Really love being there.
Ellen, you've taken the show across the country, from New York to Tulsa. I think Tulsa was one of the most recent stops, to even beyond the country. Have you done this multiple locations in one market, one city before? And I'd like you to talk about that.
Nobody has done this before, and I'm so pleased that Quantum and Carla have decided to have a longer run of the play and reach out. That's what the play is trying to do, is reach out and talk to people and let people listen to each other. Make room for that. And so this is fantastic.
The evening doesn't end when the curtain closes and the final applause ends. It continues. And why is that such an important part of the overall evening, the event, if you like?
Well, I refer you to that subtitle, Can We Talk About This? But I'll tell you, it wasn't until I actually experienced Andrew performing it that I understood how I would feel ready to share more with the people to the left and the right of me. I am in an emotional state where that feels very right. And we are thinking a lot about how that talk should go. And we asked for Ellen's advice, and she gave beautiful advice. It's really more about extending an opportunity to share your personal stories, whatever they may be, in a safe place where people want to listen, really feel like, I see you more than I saw you before we had this experience together. It doesn't end there. We hope to gather people's feelings on the political spectrum, just not in that brief 10, 15-minute talk after the show. That is about personal stories, wonderfully facilitated by a beautiful man named T.J. Parker Young, who works for Quantum. He's admired the kinds of unusual talks that have happened in our city recently at the Pittsburgh Public Theater and at City Theater, I'll say, to give props to those companies that have done a beautiful job. So it's a different kind of talk back, and it's, again, not the end of the community conversation that we want to have. There's going to be an echo event later after the run that might be a little more on the political spectrum and give people an opportunity to take their experiences with us and move them into something that's about policy and writing. We're encouraging people to write to us and have opportunity for that on our website.
Okay. Ellen, do you feel that people might get trapped in the middle of the gun issue? They might understand perspectives from the left, from the right, and maybe that there are more than two sides.
Well, I sure hope so. I'm not sure why we keep falling into the binary on everything and feeling like there's only this or that, left or right, red or blue. We're all in this together. We're in this country and community together, and there's a lot more of us who have complex ideas about a lot of issues than have simplistic ones if we could only have space to talk with each other about it. And so that's what we're trying to do.
You know, Carl used a very simple but powerful word just a moment ago, and listen. We don't seem to listen on a number of issues, do we?
Absolutely correct. You know, listen and you will find that you are closer to each other than you might have thought. Or even just acknowledging the complexity of the issue is what we need to start moving forward.
And Ellen, do you get excited about hearing people's sort of feedback, what they're talking about, to see if they have similar or different experiences since the play is based on your experiences?
It's been amazing taking the show from Chicago to Tulsa to places across the country, even to Scotland, and hearing people's own personal experiences with guns in America, whether they were learning to hunt when they were a kid with their grandpa, whether it was military service, or whether it was the much more complicated stories that so many audiences seem to have wherever I go.
In just a couple of sentences each, what do you hope that people, when they come and see the gun show, Can We Talk About This, go home with?
I hope they're hopeful. I'm hopeful. After the play, I wasn't so hopeful. I'm in pain, but I'm hopeful, and I hope other people will be too.
I hope they feel like they sit in that room together and hear each other.
Playwright E.M. Lewis wrote The Gun Show, Can We Talk About This? Carla Booth is the founder and artistic director of Quantum Theater, which is presenting The Gun Show. The show opens at the Carnegie Library of Pittsburgh in Homewood, followed by runs later this month at CCAC, Allegheny Campus, and then the Tall Family Theater in Sewickley. We'll link to the full schedule on our website at WESA.FM. Thanks to both of you for coming in.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, and thank you, Ellen.
And for today, that is The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. Next time, 2018 was the wettest year on record here in Pittsburgh, causing dozens of landslides in the area, forcing people out of their homes and costing the city millions in repairs. What preventative measures can be taken for this year? Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski. Production assistance by Meg Fair, Mick Stanelli, Julia Zenkovich, and Alex Lenigan. The editor and producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.